There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1086, March 17th, 2025. Steven.
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads provide you, the F1Weekly.com web surfer, with ads that interest you. From tickets to the Canadian Grand Prix to ringtones for your cell phone, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Yahoo. On today's program, wow, 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 Norris supreme under pressure. Yuki out-qualifying Liam is a statement indeed. Kimi Antonelli stays very calm, finishes P4, and Max performs with an underperforming car, as usual. And more classic Nasser Hamid this week with the history of Clay Regazzoni after his passing in 2006. And our interview, Joss the Boss Verstappen. A brief one. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, what a fantastic start of the season. Chaos, dry, wet conditions, tires burning up. I'm telling you, and of course, the rookies crashing on the formation lap. I felt bad for Hajar, but there you go. The learning curve begins. But what an impressive race. What an impressive qualifying for Yuki, throwing down the gauntlet and asking the question, why am I not Max Verstappen's teammate? So that's all very fascinating, but we did have a good one. And it's Piastri's hometown race, of course, Doohan, another Aussie in the Grand Prix who has to do well because Flavio has got the Colapinto hotline ready to go. So it's going to be very interesting for the next 23 races. We have China next week, but this was an exciting Grand Prix. Like Norris said, quality decision-making in the pits really made the difference for them. Everybody made mistakes, but in the end, and we even had Lewis Hamilton leading the race briefly, but boy, did we have a frustrated Lewis Hamilton on the radio. You could tell that this is a new relationship. They don't know each other. So there's a long way to go for Lewis and Ferrari to pick up the pace because I know they have the speed. So in China, if we have a dry race, things could level out. But really, it was all about two rookies that finished in the top. I have to just hand it to Ollie Bearman and Kimi Antonelli. Why don't we hear from Kimi?
I wanted the podium so bad, but I wasn't aware about the penalty, but which was unfortunate, but I really cannot complain about today. The team did a great job. They guided me through, especially, after I had the mistake, I kind of hurt my confidence a little bit in that team. The team did great to calm me down and to get me back into the rhythm. So, also they made all the right calls. And really, really happy about today.
For you.
I mean, it was super difficult, especially, the start and behind the safety car, the tires were cooling down massively and the grip was nowhere, And also with all these wide lines, it's super, super tricky because as soon as you go over them on traction or even in a high-speed corner, you lose the grip from all of a sudden. So it's always very, very tricky. And especially on the slick, you know, was quite scary, but really happy with how everything went.
Gracias, Kimi. Keep up the good work. But that was a fantastic Grand Prix from the very start. I thought they would start with a rolling start with this kind of weather, but I'm glad they did not. I know Zach Brown was hoping for that. And in the end, it was the right decision. It was a great start for Norris. I think I saw more maturity in Norris. He's not intimidated by Max or anybody else besides him. Of course, locking up the front row for McLaren is just telling the world that we are the team to beat this season. We know Red Bull and Honda. Honda's on their last leg. There is no more development for Red Bull. I think they're going to barely make it. I don't see Max winning the championship. On the other hand, Norris even said it himself, that he's more confident, he's calmer on the radio, and the team is making better decisions. When you put that all together, that could very well be a driver winning the world championship at the end of the season. Kudos to Norris. I'm proud of him. Unfortunately, the rain came exactly at the wrong time for Piastri because I was really hoping for an Aussie win for Piastri. It would have been just awesome, emotional, fun, and a great beginning to his hunger for a world championship. But right now, I think Piastri has got some catching up to do. Lando is calmer, and this is going to be Norris's big shot at it. I think this is it. And clearly the McLaren is the fastest car on the circuit at the moment. Of course, Lando wanted to make sure that everybody understands that it's not just the car, which is something I've been saying for 20 years. Even with the fastest car, you do have to perform. You have to make the least amount of mistakes. So I think Lando Norris has graduated to that level, and we're all very proud of him. Fernando crashing out, not too good for the host of F1Weekly.com, but it was treacherous out there, and obviously Aston Martin will be mid-pack at best. Really surprised on Carlos crashing, but I think they may have mapped the motor incorrectly, and I don't know. But in the end, Carlos helped Albon and the team make proper decisions, with Albon finishing fourth. Of course, Antonelli had a penalty and dropped a P5. Stroll P6. He's, you know, maybe we are being too mean. Has Nasser Hamid been too mean to Lance Stroll's little Jimmy Clark? So I was proud of Lance Stroll. Yuki Tsunoda really had some bad luck. And to start P5 and finish P12 really is not what I expected from him. I think Liam Lawson, if he can't gather it up soon, Dr. Marco will go chop chop. He needed to come in much more prepared than he showed us. So very disappointed for Liam, and really George Russell. I mean, I think he's on it this season. He could be in contention depending if Mercedes has good pace in China and shows that they can compete with McLaren. But McLaren's advantage is managing the tires. And if they can hold on to that advantage at least till halfway through the season, they've got a big shot at both championships. So I'm very, very intrigued on how this is all going to turn out and whether Adrian Newey will be able to affect anything on this 2025 car, because really they do have a new wind tunnel, but all the work is going to be going on for the 2026 car to bring Fernando his third championship. Interesting to watch Lewis Hamilton grow with Ferrari. Ferrari needs to clean up their crap. They should have been quicker. And once again, everybody knows that the Pirelli wet tires are very crappy. So we've got a fantastic season ahead. I truly believe this is Lando Norris's championship to lose. I don't think I think Max will be there on the podium all the time, but the McLaren is managing those tires so well. I do believe Piastri will get a lot of wins this year too. Nico Hülkenberg, wow. P7 for Sauber. They need those points. Turning into Audi pretty soon. And I'm sure, you know, he'll do always well in the rain. I remember his A1GP race in the rain was unbelievable. So there you have it. Yuki's going to keep complaining if Liam does not progress much quicker than I think is possible. I hate to be mean, Liam is a nice kid, but he's just nowhere near Max and that car. I don't know. Is Perez going neener, neener? I told you so. It's possible. But Toto was a very happy camper today. Both cars up there in the top five. So I think he is the happiest team principal besides Zach Brown. So that's my take on this. We do have some good classic Nasser Hamid coming up. It's the history of Clay Regazzoni. Back in 2006, Clay Regazzoni was involved in a car accident in Parma, Italy, which proved fatal and which broke Nasser's heart. So he had to do a little historical perspective. And then we'll do a quick conversation with one of our favorites, Jos Verstappen. I honestly can't remember where this was, but I believe it could have been at Laguna Seca. So, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy the show. I can't wait for China. I'm hoping it's a dry race because I want to see reality play out. But once again, you have to tip your hat to McLaren. They are now the favorites. Clearly, Lewis Hamilton winning his eighth championship is definitely a stretch. And he is 40 years old. So we have two old men of the sea. Well, three really with Nico Hülkenberg. Wow. What a fantastic Grand Prix. I want to thank Jason Bentley, the original JB, for helping me out with a VPN to watch the race. I'm out in France right now, and it's a struggle to find an Airbnb that actually has cable TV. All these people just stream really crappy stuff. So bear with us. F1 Weekly will fight till the end to stay on the air, and I hope you stay tuned. Thank you very much, and enjoy Nasser Hamid.
Welcome, Nasser, to F1Weekly.com. For our interviews segment, we've gotten some great interviews over the Formula One season, attending other races, historical races, open wheel races, and obviously your trip to Europe has definitely got us some good stuff. And this next interview I find fascinating because this gentleman has had a fantastic career, but it's pot-marked by interesting moments and decisions. And obviously I'm talking about Jos the Boss Verstappen.
Yes, Jos the Boss, as he's called in his native Holland, was born in March 1972 and had a very impressive and fast climb to Formula One racing. Like Jarno Trulli in Formula One today, he participated in less than 50 car races before arriving in Grand Prix racing, which I think is very, you know, too quick, too fast, too soon. But then again, on the other hand, Kimi Raikkonen made it to Formula One with less than 25 races.
So if you've got the gift, some people can do that big leap, but it's not advised.
No, you need to have some experience. And, you know, I think what really screwed up Jos Verstappen, I think he's a pretty fabulous race car driver, is that he just arrived in a big league way too soon. But that's just my opinion. Anyway, Verstappen started in karting at the age of 8 and was junior Dutch champion at the age of 12. Later in his karting career, he won two European titles. In 1993, he won the famous Marlboro Masters at Zandvoort, the Dutch track, and the German Formula 3 Championship. He made his Formula 1 debut in 1994 at the Brazilian Grand Prix. His final Formula 1 race was the 2003 Japanese Grand Prix. In all, he took part in 107 Grand Prix races and was on the podium on two occasions, back-to-back races in Hungary and Spa in 1994.
Now, 1994, I find a very interesting year to come into Formula One. He was there when they had the famous fire at the Benetton pits.
German Grand Prix.
German Grand Prix. And he was teammate to Michael Schumacher.
That's the last thing you want when you're a young driver.
Some people call it the kiss of death.
Absolutely, it is. I mean, lap of death.
Exactly. And so a lot of people say that could have been the beginning of the end.
There's no question about it. You know, the last thing you want, especially when you have not established yourself, you're young, and you're a teammate to anybody like Michael Schumacher, Ayrton Senna, or as Felipe Massa will find out next year, Kimi Raikkonen, you're pretty much done. Because you get exposed that you cannot run with the top dog. And once that stigma or is established, then no top team. And as you know, in Formula One or in any series, there are only two or three teams that can get you a championship. And even these teams go through ups and downs. Look at Williams and McLaren. So if you're not in the right team at the right time, it's very hard. And if you have a teammate that's Schumacher or Senna or Raikkonen, you know, have a nice day.
I agree with you completely.
And he drove for many teams. He drove for Benetton, Simtek, Footwork, Tyrrell, Stewart, Arrows, and Minardi. But he's now making a pretty good name for himself as the lead driver for Team Holland in A1 GP Series. And we saw him race at Laguna Seca also. Actually, he had a very bad day. I think
he had a terrible day.
Yeah.
He was getting out of the car completely frustrated. And that was Jos at his worst.
Yeah, he was really pissed off. And I remember him walking out of the pit lane because he was given a penalty. So he stopped his car. And the team principal for Team Holland is another ex-Formula One driver, Jan Lammers. Pretty nice guy. And I remember watching Lammers trying to talk to him. And Jos just blew him by. But, you know, we all have our bad hair day. So this interview is my conversation with him. I ran into him at the European Karting Championship in Marienburg, Belgium, on September 3rd. Enjoy.
Fantastic. Thank you. Listen to the interview of Jos, the boss, Verstappen.
I'm here with Jos Verstappen. Jos, you were in go-kart racing. What brings you here today?
Watching the people driving.
Is anybody driving for you?
No. I don't have a team anymore. I work with my son and a friend of mine.
Okay.
And we're just interesting, of course, in go-karts and see the people again who we worked with in the past, and just keep the, you know, the information, see what's happening.
And if I'm not mistaken, you went from go-kart racing to Formula One.
Yeah, in 2.5 years' time. Yeah.
I remember your days in Formula One. Quick question, what is your favorite track in Formula One circuit?
Spa.
Absolutely.
A little bit further up here.
So yeah.
Spa is a very nice track, and it's just everything in it, and that makes it so special.
I have a question for you. You know, last year and this year also, Montoya had a habit of running into people, or even when he was ahead of people, he would run into Montoya.
Yes.
And then you had an incident with him in Interlagos, right? Can you tell me what happened there?
Well, obviously I drove in the back of him, and so you can't blame him for that. That was something very strange, but I think that was not his fault. But I think at the end of his time in Formula One, he was very frustrated. And I think when you don't have the support of the team, I think you get very frustrated. And I think he made a good choice for himself to go to NASCAR. You know, it's more friendly. And Formula One is not such a nice place if you not have the team behind you.
What was your most memorable moment in Formula One?
I had a few ups and downs. But I think my third position in Hungary was good, especially after the fire we had in 2 weeks before that. So that was one of the best memories I had.
And the A1 season start in Zandvoort in October. You're the lead driver, I believe.
Yep. Yeah, we're going to do it another year, so I'm happy with that. No, I'm looking forward. I mean, we did a two-day test last week, and I think we are close to the front, and that makes it very exciting again.
What made Team France so dominant last year?
They had a very good engineer, and obviously the engineer left to Germany, and no, Germany was quicker. So, that makes it a good challenge. And I think the times will be closer now than it was last year. So more exciting moments on television.
So you think that we'll be in for a Dutch treat this year?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. You know, any message for F1 Weekly listeners? We do a podcast in America.
Well, come and watch America race again this year. And I think A1, it's a nice series and very interesting to watch, and absolutely a lot of action.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate your time.
And now we're introducing an interview with definitely a fairly colorful character in the American Motorsports series. And that gentleman is
Johnny Rutherford, known as Lone Star JR because he had the Texas flag on his helmet. JR is a three-time winner of the Indy 500, 1974, 1976, and 1980. He was born in 1938 in Coffeyville, Kansas. He won 3 pole positions at the Brickyard. He also dabbled in your favorite N-Series, making 35 starts in Winston Cup between 1963 and 1988. He retired from racing, as a driver, in 1994. In 1965, he was the national sprint car champion and was the IndyCar champion in 1980. He has been a staunch supporter of Indy Racing League, and my understanding is he goes to all the events and is the driver of the pace car, plus other advisory functions to TG, Tony George, the great emancipator of screwing up American open wheel racing. Rutherford is still based in Dallas-Fort Worth area, and again, another very nice guy, easy to approach, easy to talk to, and I'm very thankful for him to give us the time he did.
Yeah, very, very nice guy, great gentleman, and I really loved his attitudes towards promoting the IRL series. I'm not a big IRL fan, but when I asked him, and please listen to the interview, you'll find that his inner motivation for this series is still right there at the top, and you'll notice it in the interview.
Absolutely. You know, I was also pretty taken by the way he, you know, when we asked him to do a message for our listeners, and he invited listeners to, instead of bashing Cart or something else, he was very gracious and very professional.
Very professional, and I can see why Tony George has him on the promo staff, because he's very, very good.
Yeah, he is. And it's, you know, let's see what happens. Let's just hope it the two cities merge for the better of everybody.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nasser, and thank you, Johnny Rutherford.
How you doing, Johnny?
Good.
What brings you to Sonoma today?
Well, we've got a race here. I'm involved with the Indy Racing League. And so we're here for an event, and this is the next to last race in our racing schedule, and we go to Chicagoland Raceway in a couple of weeks to wind things up. So, but it's very nice out here in California, and the weather's better than it's been at any of our other venues, so we're pleased with that.
You've won three Indy 500s. Which one of these was the best?
Well, I think any time you win's the best. You really can't single them out. I guess if I had to categorize them, the best would have been the first, because I started so far back in the field. I started 25th starting spot and moved to the front. And A.J. Foyt, my old nemesis from Houston, and I had a real hammer and tong battle during the middle stages of the race, and I went on to win the thing. So it was very good. Probably the third one would have been my second choice because of the Chaparral, the Pennzoil Chaparral, the first true ground effects car. Dominated, had quick time, set on the pole, and led the most laps and won the race. The third one would have been the Rain Shortened. You know, we went just past halfway in the event, and it rained very hard, and they decided to cancel, and I was the first to walk into victory lane. So they all had their own character, and anytime you can win the Indianapolis 500, it's a pretty special occasion.
Now, you've driven against some of the great legends of that era. Which one was really the one that gave you the most competitive edge or the hardest fight?
I think there were a lot of those. You know, you talk about A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti and Parnelli Jones and Al Unser and Bobby Unser, and you know, there was a whole gang of us that raced sprint cars and midgets and stock cars and everything together, and so it never was easy to win one. You had to really have it all together, and that's what made it so much fun.
That's fantastic. Now, you're also known. You're known as Lone Star JR. Are you still living in the Fort Worth area?
Yes, Fort Worth, Texas is home, and it has been for a long time. So, I enjoy being from Fort Worth, and, of course, having some Texas heritage. And it's I enjoy that. The Lone Star JR was something they hung on me many years ago, and I'm kind of proud of that.
Thank you very much. Any message for our F1 Weekly listeners all over the world?
Oh, yeah. Come see the Indy Racing League. We're having a good time. And come to Indianapolis. That's where the action is and the fastest race cars in the world.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We want to give a big birthday shout out to one of our favorite friends on MySpace, Trisha. Happy birthday from the staff of F1Weekly.com. Hip, hip, hooray! There you have it. And now, Trisha, enjoy your birthday. We're going to go into some listener email. And I don't usually read the listener email because I'm already overworked as it is here at F1Weekly.com. But this one is very intriguing. And when they're great emails,
I always like to partake in them because I find them very, very cool and interesting, and F1 Weekly loves their listeners. Whether they like us or not, we still think they're great listeners. So let me start off. This is from Chris Stittmart. He didn't tell us where he's from, but hopefully he'll email us back and let us know. Hello, Clark and Steve. I just finished listening to your podcast number 92 and have a response. I had to laugh at your statement that Ferrari lacks integrity. Based on an F1 Rejects claim that he was ordered by Ferrari to block for Schumacher nearly 10 years ago. I know that your podcast is biased towards the baby blue team, but advertising yourself as the premier F1 podcast, I would expect there to be a slight hint of journalistic integrity. Just to deem this claim to be accurate is absurd. If this had any truth to it, Noberto would have come out with this information years ago. But being a washed-up never was, how else do you think he'd get his 15 minutes of fame? Does he give, or did you find evidence to support this assertion? Is there any evidence that he actually did block Jacques Villeneuve? No. You take this little blurb and run with it like it validates your belief that Ferrari is the worst thing that happened to motorsports. Maybe next time you'll just type up your own fraudulent source document, like Tom Brokaw, to support the conspiracy theorists that are involved in the Ferrari-Schumacher witch hunt. I am not a Ferrari fan. I am an F1 fan and tend to follow drivers, Raikkonen, now Kubica, rather than teams, so don't attempt to label me as an FIA-Rari sympathizer. If you are trying to improve and promote F1 and other non-N-series related motorsports, why don't you spend so much time perpetuating the negative propaganda, stereotypes, and beliefs? But it's your podcast, and we're all just listening to it. But we don't have to believe all of your skewed beliefs and rants. There you have it, and there you go. Keep up the work. No, it's not a typo. Well, thank you, Chris. We're going to have a little reaction to your email because I find it very fascinating. First of all, I certainly have never said that Ferrari is the worst thing that's happened to motorsports. I love Ferrari. I used to wear red. I think Ferrari is wonderful. And I think you've taken some of my spiels a little too seriously. Also, I am half French and I do support Renault and I make no bones about it. And I'm going to bring in one of our historical correspondents who's going to talk about this. Obviously, everybody knows Nasser. Nasser Hamid, how are you today?
Very good. Thank you.
You've heard the email. People wonder why sometimes it takes people so long to come out with the truth. I mean, real quickly, Renault has no Rosgas moment. We have no 1994 and Damon Hill moment or Jacques Villeneuve in 97 moments. So maybe I'm wrong.
Clark, I think you're a full frog, not a half frog. First of all, I want to thank Chris for writing.
Absolutely.
And I have to agree with
him. I thought it was a great email.
Yeah, you are biased towards baby blue.
I do agree.
And you're proud of it, too, which is fine.
I thank Ferrari for always doing a great job when they're beating Renault.
You know, and they're a part of Formula One. Formula One is Ferrari, and Ferrari is Formula One. No question about it. But, you know, I have to agree with Chris. I have concerns like he does. Why do people take so long to come up with these things? We saw this at the time of the, and I don't want to turn this into a political finger pointing, but last election we had all sorts of accusation events that happened 30 years ago. The person, whether he was there or not, why is he talking now? You had 30 years to say something. And you remember the schmazzle we had with Clarence Thomas when he was trying to become,
indeed.
You know, Anita
indeed.
Hill came out with all these accusations. Why wait 25, 30 years? You know, people do these things for some sort of a benefit. I don't think last 30 years Norberto Fontana was sleeping in Buenos Aires, you know. But at the same time, on the flip side is, I was not there. The only two people who know what the truth is Norberto Fontana and Jean Todt. Other than that, I don't know what the truth is. But I got to tell you something, in talking to a lot of industry insiders for the last 2 years, and these are people or corp companies that have been involved in motor racing for 30 to 50 years. a lot of things happen behind the scenes that most people, myself definitely included in that, don't even know. And deals are made. And as a very good example, I will refer and invite Chris to listen to our interview with Francois Castin. You know, here's a guy who designed the first turbo engine and was spearheading Chrysler's entry into Formula One with the Lamborghini engine, mm-hmm. how he was dealing personally with Ron Dennis.
Yes, very interesting stuff.
Yes, and, you know, like he said, they had shaken hands at a motor show in Germany. Everything was done except, you know, it was not signed. And then Ron cut a deal with somebody else. So things do happen, kinky stuff, not good stuff, not ethical stuff. But in the case of Fontana, I really don't know what the truth is.
I agree with you. And it is odd that all of a sudden this comes out 10 years afterwards. But and maybe he did want to know, you know, people. I mean, I have to admit, the name Noberto Fontana has not been in the limelight for a long, long time. This was his 15 minutes of fame. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean that he was lying.
No, not at all. And there could be some element of truth. Maybe some, you know, innuendos were made.
I suggest to Chris and anybody else who doubts this is true, is to watch that specific race and listen to Murray Walker's coverage of Noberto blocking Jacques Villeneuve and how he thought Noberto should be rewarded with a case of champagne for doing such a fine job.
Would you like to tell him where he can view that video? It's also on GrandPrix.com because www.grandprix.com recently had this new segment.
Exactly.
And they also put that video. And there's a funny comment from Martin Brundle also. But is there any other source you can go to, like YouTube or anything? That
it's possible, but what we're going to do is we're going to try to get that video and put a link on our website in the next few days or so, so people could see and judge for themselves to see if, you know, maybe I'm taking this too seriously. But this only happened for me is when Ferrari went to the FIA at Monza and complained about Fernando Alonso blocking Felipe Massa. And when you look at the film, Felipe Massa is 100 meters back. These are the little things that get under my skin. And Chris, you're right. It is my show. And sometimes I do go overboard. And I never intend to insult anybody. But I got to have a few laughs, too.
Well, you know, it's like, you know, some years ago when Alonso won his first race in Hungary, they had this issue of Michelin tires.
Oh, yes.
You know, again, that was not something that those tires got wider in that race. It has been going on. All the people knew that. But then when the time was very opportunistic,
yes,
it was brought to their attention.
Ferrari and Bridgestone have a history of strategic complaining to the FIA. They wouldn't do it at the beginning of the season when everything is fairly wide open. They always wait till towards the end when things start getting heated, and then all of a sudden, boom, boom, boom. I mean, come on. Don't take my word for it. It's all there in film, and take a look at it.
Well, as a point of reference, you know, just for historical purposes, 1975 U.S. Grand Prix Watkins Glen. There was a tremendous duel between Niki Lauda and Clay Regazzoni. I'm sorry, Niki Lauda and Emerson Fittipaldi. Lauda being in a Ferrari and Fittipaldi being in a McLaren. And I have spoken to people who were there, and the way they described that these cars were like almost touching each other, lap after lap. That's how close Fittipaldi was. And it's a pretty famous incident. And Luca di Montezemolo was involved in this too. I'll never forget this. When they came to lap or pass Clay Regazzoni, he let Lauda go, mm-hmm. Ferrari teammate. But he held up Fittipaldi for quite a bit. And I remember Fittipaldi saying that had he not done that, I would have given Lauda the race of his life. And this was, the race was, I think, the last or second last race of the season. And Lauda had already won the championship from Fittipaldi. So he really wanted to, you know, make a statement by passing the world champion. And I remember when they complained to Luca di Montezemolo, who was then a very young team manager, all he kept saying, it was, and you know, reported in the press all over, that's not important thing. Important thing. Important is we win.
Exactly.
So, but exactly. That's high-stake motor racing.
And it is motor racing, and these things have been happening for years and years and years, and they will continue to happen. But the politics of Formula One are always fun to talk about.
And here's your F1Weekly.com Formula One trivia. As we know, former driver Clay Regazzoni died this past Saturday in a road collision near Parma in Italy. And also, as we know, he was the first person to score a victory for then the new Williams team on July 14, 1979. Now, the very next race week in Hockenheim, this driver took Williams' second victory. Who was he? I'll have the answer toward the end of the podcast.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now we're going to do a tribute to Clay Regazzoni. As everybody knows, he was killed in a car accident earlier this week in Italy. So I've brought Nasser Hamid, of course, our historical correspondent, into the studio. And he's got a lot of information. This is one of the favorite eras for Nasser. And I want to get him in here, talk about Regazzoni, bring us some historical perspective, some info, and a good tribute to this man's wonderful career in Formula One and other racing activities. Nasser, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Fine, thank you. You know, you're very right. This era is very dear to me. This is anytime you mention a name from that time, whether they were world champion or not, it goes very deep, you know, in my passion of motor racing, especially Formula One. Regazzoni, Peterson, Sever, Jackie Stewart, Freddie Parley, it's just, you know, Colin Chapman, anybody from that era, you know, just even the sponsors, Al for Yardley McLaren. And this was very sad, you know. Clay Regazzoni, very likable guy. And, you know, news is still coming in. Like today it was in the news that according to the autopsy done, there were no fatal injuries. He apparently had a heart attack, which could have been induced by the accident itself. Yeah. Or maybe he crashed because of the heart attack. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And he was killed last Friday. And the news came from the Italian news agency ANSA that 67-year-old Swiss driver was driving a silver Chrysler Voyager when he collided with another car and a truck on the A1 Milan-Bologna motorway near Parma. And Parma is the Italian town where Parmalat came from, you know, sponsored again from the 80s. He was born, his real name was Gian Claudio Giuseppe Regazzoni, and he was born on September 5, 1939 in Lugano. He grew up in the Ticino region of Italian-speaking Switzerland. But as we all know, most of the people, at least in racing, knew him as Clay around the world. And he was also known as Rega. A lot of time people refer to him as Rega. And according to his website, www.clayregazzoni.com, in 1963 and 64, he competed in events driving Austin Sprite 950 and Morris Cooper S.
And so, real quickly, I want to mention to everybody that this website, it's a great website. Go to it. We encourage it. But it's all in Italian.
That is correct, and there are all these stats for him, which you can figure out. And also, interestingly, he had also started a Clay Regazzoni watch collection, where most of the proceeds, from what I understand, goes to charity to help people who have been disabled. So if somebody is interested in, you know, buying a Clay Regazzoni watch, they can do it from this website. Again, it's www.clayregazzoni.com or ZZONI. .com in England, Australia, Papua New Guinea. Okay, so my guess is that his earliest competition, serious type, started out in 63-64. In 1965, he competed in Formula 3 Championship, and for the next 4 years, he was a regular on the Formula 3 and Formula 2 Championships. As you know, in those days, drivers would do a lot of races, you know, both sides of the pond. And it was in, unfortunately, you know, throughout his career, he was involved, he was known as kind of a wild guy. He was involved in a lot of accidents, kind of like James Hunt. And I'll mention some of the major, you know, events that took place in his career. It was in 1968 at Zandvoort, Holland. In a Formula 2 race, he was involved in a serious accident which took the life of English driver Chris Lambert and a female spectator. As a side note, Chris Lambert and his friend operated their own team, LRT, London Racing Team. And name of Chris's friend was, listen to this, Max Mosley. Yes, the same Max that was the M in March cars and the same Max who was sipping tea in his high-rise Monaco apartment during the debacle that Clark, you and I attended as strangers in Indianapolis in 2005.
Yes, one of my favorite moments, but I still had a good time that day.
Well, I wanted to see more than six cars race, but it was pretty obvious after two laps what was going on, and I can just, you know, console myself by saying I was part of a historic Formula One Grand Prix. You know, 20 years down the road, they will still be talking about it.
Yeah, my attitude completely.
Yeah, and I thank the Bibendum for sending me a check for refund. So that was nice.
That was nice.
1970 was a breakthrough year for Regazzoni. He won the Formula 2 championship driving a Techno and also made his Formula 1 Grand Prix debut with Ferrari. And ironically, the debut came at Zandvoort in Holland. And he had a very impressive start to his Formula 1 career. In his first race, Dutch Grand Prix, he qualified sixth and finished fourth. And, you know, you got to be very proud of your achievement if you finish fourth in your very first Grand Prix. And if you look at the names that were racing in those days, Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart, a lot of big names. So pretty good start for him. And unfortunately, this was the race, the 1970 Dutch Grand Prix, in which another British driver, Piers Courage, perished in a fiery accident aboard Frank Williams entered De Tomaso, the same Frank Williams who was running the Williams Grand Prix engineering today.
Right, and this is the Piers Courage of the Courage family, the big beer family.
That is correct.
Big brewery.
And you have a...
Now, I keep a towel in my garage of Courage Brewing to remind me of Piers, because he was a cool, hip dude.
Yes, he was. In his second Formula One start at the British Grand Prix at Brands Hatch, if you remember, in those days, British Grand Prix would go from Brands Hatch on even years, I believe, to odd number years, to Silverstone. Regazzoni again qualified sixth and duplicated his debut result by finishing fourth for the second time in two races. And on his fifth Formula One start, he won the hearts of the Tifosi's and Ferrari management, which is an almost impossible task, by winning his first Grand Prix of all the places at Monza Autodromo.
Your favorite.
All time, always will be. Now, just imagine an Italian-speaking driver from Switzerland winning at Monza his first race in a Ferrari. That's pretty impressive. And again, this was the sad weekend which saw Jochen Rindt losing his life on Saturday when this Lotus 72 crashed at high speed heading towards Parabolica.
And of course, he had accrued enough points and he won the world championship posthumously that year.
That is correct. First Austrian to become world champion.
Not many drivers were able to get Enzo's admiration. But
I can only think of two people, Tadzio Nuvolari and Gilles Villeneuve. And I am sure if he was alive today, Michael Schumacher would definitely, because he fit everything he wanted in a race car driver. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things, whether you like Michael Schumacher or not, he does not complain too much. And he does not need have the season to adjust to the brake pedal on a Ferrari, because the brake pedal was different on a Benetton. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, thank you. Grazie. Okay, Regazzoni finished his first season in Formula One on a high note by grabbing his first pole position in the final race in Mexico City and finishing second to teammate Jackie Ickx in the race. By the way, this 1970 Mexican Grand Prix, have you seen what happened there?
No, I can't.
The crowd control was... That's how Mexico lost
the Grand
Prix.
Well, in the early 70s, it was out of control.
These guys, during the race, were like maybe a few feet away, no fences, and just sitting there on the ground. It was like very chaotic. And I remember, I remember reading that Pedro Rodriguez had gone out and pleaded with people to, you know, back off and all that. So, but that's another story in itself. In the World Championship, he was third. So in his first full season, first season in Grand Prix racing, he missed some of the races because he was not a Ferrari driver throughout the season. He still finished third, which is very impressive. There were no Grand Prix wins in 1971 for Regazzoni, but he did win the non-championship race of champions at Brands Hatch. And this was, again, a very common race with Formula One cars and drivers, but never counted towards the championship, but was a regular feature every year. And sadly, that's gone now. And was second with teammate Jackie Ickx in the BOAC 1,000-kilometer sports car race at the same venue. And again, this is another major sporting event they used to have. BOAC being the British Airways, British Overseas Airways Corporation. Okay, teaming up with the British driver Brian Redman, and we all know who that is. He also won the 9 hours of Kyalami sports car race, which would be South Africa. And the 1972 Formula One season for him was also winless. and he finished seventh in the Drivers' Championship. And again, he was winner at the Kyalami 9-hour sports car race, this time driving with the Italian driver Arturo Mazzario.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners that at this stage in Formula One, these drivers were racing a lot of different formulae. I mean, they were doing a number of things while still staying with the regular Formula One schedule.
Yeah, they did Formula One, Formula Two, some would hop over for the Indy and sports car racing.
The endurance races.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, it was in a, you know, I would say silly, meaningless Formula Two race that Jim Clark lost his life.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just pathetic. Okay, after the, and he also had one major win in 1972, which he shared with Jackie Ickx. Winning again at Monza, the 1,000-kilometer Monza race. And then he left the Ferrari stables for the 73 season and joined BRM. Regazzoni only scored 2 points in BRM, being British Racing Motors, and finished the season in 18th position. It was in the South African Grand Prix early in the season that Regazzoni was involved in another serious accident. On lap 3, his car caught fire after colliding with Mike Hillwood's Surtees. Regazzoni was trapped unconscious in his car while Hillwood and Marshall jumped into the flames to get him out. This video, have you ever seen video of this?
You know, I've seen it actually on YouTube.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, car is burning and Mike Hillwood jumps in and then he's running out with his hands and shoes on fire. And Regazzoni was rushed to hospital even though he had he was unconscious, but he suffered only minor burns and was okay. And for his efforts, all caught on tape, like we just discussed, Hillwood was awarded the George Medal for Bravery by Her Majesty, the Queen of England.
And I want to remind our listeners, Mike Hillwood tragically was killed a few years later in a road car accident.
That is correct. You know, another sad story there. He was like John Surtees. He was world champion in motorcycling. Then he came to Grand Prix racing. And in his case, you know, he was just going to fetch some, like a fast food takeout with his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And then got into a serious accident and both were killed.
Very sad.
Yeah, sure. Okay. At the end of September, he also took part in a Formula 5000 race. And this was another series that was very big at one time. And a lot of drivers, top-name drivers, Mario Andretti, raced in this also. Regazzoni took part in a Formula 5000 race at Kent Raceway near Seattle, finishing second in Heat 1 in a Lola Chevrolet. And he also took victory at the Wheel of Fortune Tommaso Pantera. Remember the Panteras?
Oh, yeah.
In the European GT Series race at Hockenheimring, which would be Germany. What happened in 19, at the end of the 73 season, both the BRM boys from that season, Regazzoni and a young Niki Lauda, were signed as drivers for 1972 by the new team manager at Ferrari, a then-young Luca di Montezemolo. And the interesting thing here is that when they contacted Regazzoni to come back to Ferrari.
Mm-hmm.
They knew who he was, and, you know, there was no lost in translation with him.
Yeah.
And it was Regazzoni who suggested, you know, Lauda would be a good driver to hire him also. So he basically, lack of a better word, cut his own throat. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And this 1974 season turned out to be the best year in Formula One for Clay Regazzoni, though winning only one race. And it was interesting, you know, he was, once he came back to Ferrari, he was with them 3 years, three seasons. He only won one race each year, but it was always a very important race, as we will see. His one victory, the only victory in 74, was at the mighty Nürburgring in Germany, which was, you know, the old 14.2 mile.
The big boy.
Yeah. And he was on the podium six other times and took the fight with Thierry Pardy for the championship to the final round at Watkins Glen. He was Grand Prix. Both were on 52 points before the U.S. Grand Prix, but the title slipped from the Swiss as his Ferrari developed handling problems which could not be fixed despite a tire chain. They thought there was a problem with tire, but there was more like suspension problem. So Regazzoni did not score any points in that race, final race, and Fittipaldi regained his title by finishing fourth. Final championship tally was Fittipaldi 55, Regazzoni 52. And I remember the season very well.
We had major tragedy at this race.
Yeah, for the second year at the U.S. Grand Prix, a driver was killed. In 74, there was this young Austrian, Helmut Koenig. He was killed during the race, and he was actually decapitated. And the year earlier, you know, your fellow Frenchman, François Sévère, was killed.
Yeah,
he was killed in practice or qualifying, not in the race. So tragedy, fatalities at Watkins Glen, both 73 and 74. Not good. In 1975, there were two memorable wins for Regazzoni. This would be his second year after coming back to Ferrari. His only, in this race, I remember like it was yesterday, Clark, even though it was like 31 years ago. And I'll give you a little personal remembrance of this race. His only Formula One win came at Monza on a day when Lauda finished third and became Ferrari's first world champion since John Surtees in 1964, and Regazzoni was fifth in the driver's standings. Now, this race, you know, was in September, and the race when I was living in your favorite city.
Karachi.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Used to be around, races used to start around 7 o'clock local time in the evening, and the Italian Grand Prix was always a half hour earlier, 6:30. And this was before I discovered Radio France and live commentary, so I had to wait till like 10:45 p.m., to get the result from BBC World Service, a sports report. Being England, they would first item would be Grand Prix motor racing, always. So I remember the guy who was giving the commentary, probably it was Simon Taylor or somebody, and I'll never, ever forget what he said at the end of the report. But tonight, Monza belongs to Claire Regazzoni, Niki Lauda, and the Ferrari team. It's just like embedded in every cell I have in my body.
That's beautiful.
Grazie. Then we move on to, okay, there was going to be another when that was important in 75. And this was the non-championship Swiss Grand Prix. And I remember this race also very well. This was held in France at Dijon-Prenois since racing has been banned in Switzerland since the 1955 Le Mans crash. The 1976 season was his final with Ferrari. And this is where he won his third race with Ferrari, second time around. And the victory in the inaugural U.S. Grand Prix West at Long Beach was the highlight of the season. And he was again fifth in the Drivers' Championship. Well, this was pretty much the start of beginning of the end for him in his Formula One career. Mm-hmm. He also discovered how cold Formula One can be. Towards the end of the 76 season, he was pushing Enzo Ferrari. And how many people really succeeded in doing
in pushing
that?
Enzo.
Yeah. Yeah, he wanted Enzo to confirm his seat at Ferrari for the 77 season. And at Monza, he had offers from McLaren and Brabham. Brabham was then headed by Bernie Ecclestone. And Regazzoni later learned, and he was very disappointed about this, that Enzo had signed Carlos Reutemann, a name that will come back to haunt him again. He had signed the Argentine driver several weeks earlier and was disappointed that even Carlos did not inform him. So probably they were good friends. But that's, you know, the business of motor racing. Adding insult to the injury was Bernie's comment to him, saying now that he's no longer a Ferrari driver. Apparently, Regazzoni ran into Bernie Ecclestone a few days after the Monza Grand Prix. By that time, the word was out that Reutemann was replacing him at Ferrari. And Bernie tells him that since you are no longer a Brabham, you're no longer a driver with Ferrari, our offer is only half what we promised you at Monza.
Bernie's a nice guy, isn't he?
Oh, he's a good businessman. So, and Regazzoni, I mean, he wanted to race, but he refused Bernie's offer, saying, I like to race with nice people.
I'm with Clay on this one.
Yeah. So for 1977, he moved to Maurice Nunn, who was involved with Chip Ganassi and was hugely successful with Alex Zanardi.
Yep.
I love the way Alex Zanardi talks. And he joined Monan's hopelessly underfinanced Enzin team and had only 3-point scoring finishes. You know, when you're driving back of the bus, you're not going to win races or score a lot of points.
The beginning of the end was coming.
Yeah, absolutely. That year, he also raced at the Indy 500.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, believe it or not.
Roundy round.
Yeah, and he had a pretty spectacular crash, which is available on YouTube still. After crashing heavily in practice, he qualified his McLaren in 29th spot at over 186 miles per hour in qualifying. He dropped out after 25 laps and was classified 30th. And I remember him saying this. They asked him, you know, when he went back to Europe, how was the Indy 500? And his comment was, a lot of left turns.
Yeah, no, the Europeans aren't too used to that.
Anyway, in 1978, he drove for Don Nichols' shadow team, the U.S. operation of Mr. Don Nichols, and had 2-point paying finishes. His fledgling Formula One career received a big boost when he was signed by Frank Williams to partner Alan Jones for the 1979 season. And there he had one flash of, you know, glory. He gave Frank Williams his first Grand Prix win at Silverstone. Unfortunately, this turned out to be the last Grand Prix win for the driver. and despite finishing fifth in the championship, Regazzoni was replaced yet again by Carlos Reutemann.
Double whammy.
Yeah, you know. You got the Argent beef one more time.
Yeah.
But, you know, what are you going to do? So he was back with Monan and Zuntin, but disaster struck on the streets of Long Beach. He crashed into the park Brabham of another Argentine driver, Ricardo Zunino, at high speed following complete brake failure, and he was paralyzed from waist down and unsuccessfully sued the organizers of the race. But his spirit for life in racing saw him compete in specially modified vehicles in events like, this is very impressive, Paris to Dakar Rally, London to Sydney Marathon, and even competed some years ago at the Sebring 12-hour.
Of course. Yeah.
Driving specially modified vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, if people don't know, this guy was in a wheelchair since 1980.
And, absolutely. Yeah,
because of what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a pretty vicious accident. What happened, his car hit Zunino's car and went up in the air and crashed against a barrier. And the summary of his Formula One career, for those who are interested in stats, total Grand Prix starts, 132, 5 wins, 5 pole positions, and 212 World Championship points. And now I'll read some of the tributes that were paid to him. First one is from Frank Williams. You know,
released a first win at Silverstone in 79.
Yeah, he released a team released a press release. Clay won the very first Grand Prix for the Williams team in 1979 at Silverstone. This was probably the most important event ever to occur in the history of our time in Formula One. He was a gentleman and always a pleasure to have with us in the team. Patrick and I and other team members will always remember him. And some of these tributes I'm reading, you know, because of time constraint, I'm not reading everything they said.
Of course.
Then Luca di Montezemolo, who hired him, you know, in the first place. I remember him not only as one of my drivers during unforgettable times, but also as a true supporter of Ferrari. For him, races had to be tackled with boldness and on the limit from the first lap to the final lap. Monan was very complimentary of him. This is what he said one time. This actually, you know, tribute from Monan is on speedtv.com. So I think I should mention that.
Okay,
you know,
that's a good idea.
Before I get some sort of an email from Bob Warsha or Dave Despin, turns my head into a bobblehead.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, Monan says, one time we got to South Africa and he shows up with a couple of beautiful Delta wings. He had hired a couple of old friends from Ferrari to build them at his expense. Then he paid the freight, carried them on his commercial flight, and brought them to the try. And of course, think about it. I mean, you know, can you imagine Raikkonen or anybody doing something? They'll probably ask for, you know, special bonus to carry something.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we're in a different time zone now. And Niki Lauda, who was his teammate, he said that he described Clay Regazzoni as equal. Apparently, he had a fun-loving lifestyle. He said he was equal only by James Hunt in his ability to combine professionalism behind the wheel with the extrovert, fun-loving image of the traditional racing driver. And of course.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I, you know, two things I will always remember about Clay Regazzoni was, one, the 1975 Italian Grand Prix, and Ferrari had not won a world championship, so it was very tough time for them since 1964. And I remember as I was a spring chicken in those days. You were probably a spring frog back in 1975, and I remember this race very well. I will always remember, you know, Regazzoni winning there. And the other race was, I had mentioned a few months ago, in 1975, when Fittipaldi lost his title to Lauda, they were racing in the final race at Watkins Glen. And I have met a couple of people who were at that race at Watkins Glen in 1975, and they were saying Fittipaldi was basically touching Lauda's exhaust. They were so close for lap after lap. And then when they came to lap Regazzoni, he let Lauda go, his Ferrari teammate, and held up Fittipaldi. And what really transpired is it screwed up Fittipaldi's race, and he said, you know, I would have given Lauda a race of his life. And when they were, remember Teddy Mayer, the guy who used to own McLaren, and McLaren was complaining and protesting to Ferrari. And Luca di Montezemolo, all he kept saying was, he was a young guy in those days, this is not important. The important thing is we win, we win. That's important. So those are my two everlasting memories of Rega.
Thank you, Nasser, for sharing your thoughts on Clay Regazzoni, who was killed
last Friday.
Thank you very much.
And here's your F1weekly.com trivia answer. Aussie Alan Jones scored Williams' second victory on July 22, 1979. Incidentally, the late Clay Regazzoni was second, scoring six of his 212 lifetime points. So there's your trivia answer.